Good morning, everybody. This is the Ashmore PLC results for the year ending 30 June 2020. I'm speaking into the ether. I hope you can all hear me. I'm Mark Coombs, Chief Executive, and also on the phone slash video, who you may or may not be able to see, is Tom Shippey. We're both sitting in suitably anonymous wind-out rooms, which shows that, A, we have no lives, and this is how we actually live. This is his bedroom and mine, but they are in fact separate. And B, I've left a little challenge over my left shoulder to see if it's lurking on the screen. You can see what might be by the shade in the window, just to brighten up your day. So, on that hilarious note, first slide, please, Paul. So, overview of how we've been getting on. This is a what we would call an operating and financial performance that's pretty solid. The business model is doing what it should do, which is be resilient. A 10% roughly fall in AUM year on year, driven principally by Q3, negative market activity. Adjusted net revenues up a bit, at 5% up. EBITDA up 10, and the margin up 68. Diluted EPS up 3%. Final dividend held steady at 12.1 to give 16.9 for the year. So 2% increase in dividends over the full year. Strategically, we've continued to do what we wanted to do pretty much. In terms of fixed income, we didn't have a particularly strong Q3 in several of the asset themes. We had some good ones, but we had some pretty bad ones, which is as we would expect in crisis. And we're now generating pretty good alpha as we come out of it. Equities have been consistent and good throughout. Relative performance good throughout. Net inflows every quarter, which is that focusing on that strategic element of the business to give ourselves a balanced book is what paying off. Client base is getting broader. Both existing clients are adding assets when they have the courage, and new clients are finding us, excuse me, particularly in equity. And then we listed our first overseas subsidiary, Ashmore Indonesia, in January this year, which we're pleased to have done. And that demonstrates what we're planning to do with building local asset management businesses and then providing them as vehicles for the local market to invest in, not just to give them money to manage. COVID-19 is still running around, messing things up. It's obviously going to keep affecting markets. We think that there are different impacts in different places. Some are going to have much worse than others. Some are going to, in some ways, live with it. Some are not. And so that means there are different places for us to move, and we're active, and we do that. The deeper and larger economies have a series of things that they can do that enable them to get through this better than others, not least very deep local currency fixed income markets, which help them use their own forms of fiscal and/or monetary stimulus. In DM, developed markets, we're going to get more of that, more and more debt and lower rates for longer. And therefore, the search for growth and yield, both in equity and fixed income, favors EM over DM as far as we're concerned. Next slide, please. We think our operating model and the strength of it is demonstrated by what we do. We have one global operating platform. We were able to all transition to remote working very quickly. We've got a pretty good culture and a strong balance sheet, and we're pretty aggressive in terms of managing our costs. So when a bad thing happens, we're in better place shape than most to survive it, and we're doing that quite comfortably. Where we go from here, excuse me, other than clearing my throat, is that we'll return to the offices as and when we can, country by country. Employees' welfare is obviously a priority. In terms of our investment processes, we kept doing that consistently. We've done it in several crises before, and this is no different. This gives you an immediate mark-to-market negative impact, particularly in the fixed income space where bid-offer spreads widen to very wide levels. Liquidity initially tightens, and then it comes back. And we're in that process now. We've then done our thing. We've bought assets what we thought were cheap prices. And that means us suffer initially, and then it works out over the period. And what else have we been doing? In terms of, you've got to sit here thinking to yourselves, well, it's all very well working in a vacuum and in a padded room as we are now. But, we've tried to support broader society a bit in the UK in particular, where the head office is. We've donated to NHS Charities Together, and we provide a matching funding scheme for employees to donate to charities that they and we feel are appropriate. Next slide, please. So, global market environment. Pretty big dislocation in global capital markets. The two charts on the right show the external debt index in terms of emerging markets. spreads throughout 2020 on the top and the MSCI Equity Index performance in 20. And as you can see, pretty blowout in spreads at the end of March through March and drop of value in the equity prices. And then recovery steady since then. We're still not back to spread levels in fixed income where we were at the beginning of the year. And we're not quite at equity levels either. So there is still room to go. I think we all know what happened, a pandemic and oil price shock, because people decided to have a squabble about oil prices in terms of Saudi, et cetera, and country-specific economic challenges that arose, created stress liquidity and the dissipation we expect. Stimulus has certainly stabilized the markets towards the end of Q3, but we've still got room to go. Next slide, please, Paul. So our investment processes are designed to take advantage of this kind of thing. So we focus on liquidity, we manage redemptions, we always want to be able to give clients their money back, and we have no issues there, and we've always done that. And we add risk to capture the upside, both in our equity and high yield and investment grade fixed income. We've started to do that. If you look on the right, you can see two things. One is our blended debt strategy, which is the performance profile from January. And as you can see, pretty nasty performance against the benchmark in March, typical of severe crisis situations for us, and then flat to slightly up in April, and then we're now steadily outperforming month on month. And we would expect over the 3 year that this will give us the 3 year outperformance that we're trying to sell to people. That's blended debt. In equities, the all cap strategy, which is our core, if you like, global emerging market equity strategy. That similar profile, underperformance in March, and then outperformance every month since then. This is a strategy that's just about to reach 3 years in terms of being able to sell to people, and one of two very strong global emerging market equity strategies that we have. Next slide, Paul. So then investment performance by graph. We show you this every time we talk to you. We've slightly changed it this year just to give you a little bit more information because we think it's quite important. I guess we would, otherwise we wouldn't have changed it. But we show you 1, 3, and 5 year. And what we've done in the equity space is when we initially started equities, a lot of the volume came through in businesses like Indonesia, which are our local businesses, and in India and other places like that, where we were raising decent assets on single country basis. And what we've done, what we used to do is show you equities as one bar. And it was therefore very heavily weighted to local in terms of AUM. Now global is growing. And we'll talk a bit about global equity assets in terms of what we've been doing. So we decided to split the equity bar into two. So you can see 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year for both the global pools of capital, which would be active equity, which is growing very nicely this year, all cap, which has not yet reached its 3 year, but is performing very strongly, frontier, and small cap. And those are shown within global. And then the local covers things like the Indonesian business, the Indian business, Colombian business, et cetera. and Saudi, of course, as well. So we've broken that out a wee bit to give you a bit more info. But anyway, in terms of investment performance, 1 year, 9% of group assets outperforming, not very good. 3 years, really, given a lot of that 3 year numbers have been killed by what happened within the March period, we're getting back. That I would expect by January time, we'll be back into good 3 year territory. So that number should cross over pretty quickly. And 5 years still okay, because happily we've done pretty well for a long period of time. Pretty much as we would expect. Within the detail of that, fixed income IG investment grade strategies have done very well and continue to do very well, both in sovereign and in corporate and in local. So they're outperforming and generating alpha. Our global equity products are doing well, and our small cap equity products are doing extremely well. And we're generating alpha in pretty much every investment strategy since April. So we're hoping that we should enter next year in pretty good shape. We need to stay at it, but that's what we're hoping. Thanks, Paul. And in terms of equities, this is something particularly we want to talk about because we've been talking about this strategically for must be 5 years now. And it's been very important to us that we build a balanced book of business because we believe that what we know about emerging economies should translate into the equity space as well as the fixed income space as long as we bring in the right equity expertise. Now we've grown our own and we've added it and we've done a series of things over the years, but we've now got four very strong organic teams managing those four strategies, all cap, active, small cap, and frontier. And what's been going on in the year has been pretty good. Strong relative performance, pretty good through Q3. We've now got over 80% of our global equity assets under management. That's all cap and active, outperforming over 3 and 5 years. If you look to the box on the right, you can see all cap has got some spectacular numbers at the minute. 5 years, 700 to 800 basis points of alpha, 3 years, 500 to 500, and 1 year, 900. This is highly saleable. And as this goes through in its public equity form, in its public fund format, as the public funds go through 3 years, then we will be looking to do a lot more with this. And we think we can, this is something we're able to sell. In terms of the active space, that's now through 3 years, that's beginning to raise assets. That's raised quite nicely. A lot of those flows came into active. Hasn't had a great last 6 months, but has had a pretty good, strong performance over 3 years and is again saleable and small cap. You can see again, very heavy short-term alpha and decent 3 and 5 year. Client flow momentum is good. We're having net inflows every quarter. Active in particular driving that bus at the minute because it's been around for longer in a pure separate mandate form. We added about $1.2 billion through the full year, which is 27% of opening AUM. The percentage is a bit meaningless. You know, we obviously want to see these numbers grow. It's a mixture between existing clients increasing and new institutional mandates. We haven't lost a client in equity. We don't have that many, so that's not a massive achievement, but it's a good achievement. And so we're adding clients through this crisis, and we've added a couple recently. We feel very good about this. So we think this is where we'll see a lot of good growth. I think I've mentioned that. Okay, next one, please, Paul. I think at this point, this is where I hand over to Tom for his padded cell.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you, Mark, and good morning, everybody. So while markets and our working environment changed dramatically in early March, the resilience of Ashmore's business model and the underpinning of the strong performance in the first half meant that a solid operating and financial result has been delivered for the year overall. Assets under management fell by 9% over the 12 months to $83.6 billion. However, the level of average AUM was 11% higher compared with the prior year due to the strong investment performance and the positive net inflows delivered in the first half. Consequently, adjusted net revenues increased by 5%, driven by a 7% growth in net management fee income. And partly reflecting the more challenging revenue environment in the second half, adjusted operating costs were reduced by 5%, including a meaningful reduction in the variable compensation charge from 22.5% to 19.5% of profits. The combination of decent revenue growth and lower costs means that adjusted EBITDA increased by 10% and the operating margin was 2 points higher at 68%. The business model continues to deliver high levels of cash generation with £258 million of operating cash flow in the period. The impact of marking to market the seed capital portfolio resulted in an unrealized loss this year compared with a gain last year, a swing of over £18 million, and meaning that profit before tax increased by 1% to £221.5 million. Diluted EPS was up 3% on a statutory basis, and total dividends for the year of 16.9 pence were 2% higher than last year. Looking at the development of assets under management over the 12 months, there was a clear difference between the first and second halves. Performance and net flows were both positive in the first half. However, this reversed in the second period. Therefore, over the full 12 months, net flows were effectively flat, and the volatile market conditions in Q3, Mark described, resulted in a negative investment performance of $8.1 billion, giving year-end AUM of 83.6. A good level of gross subscriptions was achieved, with $24.3 billion being a touch higher than in the prior year. While the market environment in the second half slowed the rate of gross subscriptions, there were several consistent characteristics of client behaviour. Firstly, demand was broad-based across the headline investment themes, with good flows into local currency, corporate debt, and blended debt on the fixed income side, and strong demand for the global equity strategies. Secondly, consistent with our belief that investors will continue to raise their allocations to emerging market asset classes, the majority of institutional flows continued to be from existing clients, either adding to existing mandates or funding new exposures to additional asset classes alongside their existing accounts. Thirdly, new clients were won throughout the period, including notably after the travel restrictions were imposed in March, demonstrating the ability of the distribution team to continue to generate sales even whilst working remotely. The gross redemptions of $24.4 billion were higher than in the prior year, and again reflected the impact of the Q3 volatility, notably in two areas. First, a period of weaker performance in the short duration strategy caused certain investors to redeem during the crisis period in February and March. And second, as seen more broadly in capital markets globally at the time, some investors sought perceived safety in US dollar denominated assets and therefore sold local currency assets to raise liquidity. Overall, therefore, the group had a net outflow of $0.1 billion for the 12 months, with institutional net inflows of around $2 billion offset by intermediary retail outflows. This means that the proportion of retail capital raised through the intermediary channels fell during the year to 11% from 15% at June 2019. Ashmore's consistent strategy remains to increase this percentage over time, acknowledging that this source of capital is likely to be inherently more cyclical than a typical allocation-led institutional client. A compensating factor in terms of client mix is that the proportion of capital raised from corporates and financial institutions increased from 18% to 22% over the year, as these investors increasingly recognise the diversity and breadth of opportunities available in emerging markets. In aggregate, therefore, despite these underlying moves, the balance and diversification of the client base has been maintained. Turning now to the income statement, the 11% increase in average assets under management drove a 7% rise in net management fee income compared with the prior year. As the chart shows, there was a small tailwind from the lower average cable rate, offset by the average net management fee margin reducing by 3 basis points year on year. The main factor behind the margin movement, accounting for half of the change, is the continuing trend of allocations into large segregated accounts by existing clients, coupled with the funding of new large mandates. Investment theme mix, in particular strong growth in average AUM levels in external debt and overlay, explains 1 basis point of the movement. And finally, as I mentioned a moment ago, the redemptions in the third quarter were concentrated in higher margin mutual funds. And so this has also had a negative mix impact in the second half of the year. Other factors, including competition and other product mix effects, broadly offset each other. Looking ahead, I would continue to expect a gradual reduction in the net management fee margin of approximately 1 to 2 basis points every 12 to 24 months. Although, as we've seen in the current period, this trend line can be impacted by changes in product mix, client type, and mandate size effects. Total performance fees of £3.9 million were a million higher than in the prior year. Understandably, the impact of Q3 implies a reduced performance fee generation in the current financial year, with no performance fees being realised by eligible funds with an August year end. At this early stage in the year, and with the usual caveat around market levels and the different performance fee structures across the group, I would conservatively assume a much lower level of performance fees for the current financial year. Overall, therefore, the good growth in net management and performance fee income was tempered by smaller reductions in other revenues and hedging activities, meaning that the group delivered a 5% increase in adjusted net revenue over the year. Looking now at operating costs, and as you would expect, we've continued to maintain our strict focus on controlling operating costs, and even more so as market conditions deteriorated in the second half. Overall, a 5% reduction in adjusted operating costs was delivered. While there was some benefit from technical factors such as the adoption of IFRS 16 and a lower charge for the amortisation of intangibles, other operating costs were actively reduced by £1 million in the second half as the remote working environment was implemented and travel restrictions came into effect. The cost base absorbed the impact of a weaker sterling, and the group made charitable donations, as Mark mentioned, including match donations to employees' chosen charities totaling £300,000 in support of COVID-19 related charitable efforts. While the group delivered a solid financial and operating performance for the year as a whole, the second half was markedly different to the first 6 months, for example, in terms of client flow and investment performance. And therefore, the Remuneration Committee has set the bonus accrual at 19.5% of profits compared with 22.5% in the prior year, reducing the P&L charged by 5% to £55 million. More challenging revenue and operating environments, such as that seen over the past 6 months, highlight the benefits of the inherent cost flexibility of Ashmore's business model. It's therefore notable that despite the market and operating challenges faced, the 5% reduction in operating costs contributed to a 10% growth in adjusted EBITDA and resulted in an adjusted EBITDA margin of 68%, 2 points higher year on year. Another consistent feature of Ashmore's business model is the active management of our seed capital investments. During the year, a total of £51.4 million was invested into funds to support diversification of the group's product range and to provide clients with access to the ever-growing and developing emerging market opportunity set. For example, investments were made into new funds managing investment-grade credit, global emerging market equities, and also an equity ESG strategy to complement the blended debt ESG fund established last year. Over the past 12 months, client inflows have enabled the profitable realisation of previously seeded investments totalling £84 million, primarily from the corporate debt and equity themes. There was also a return of capital from funds in the alternatives theme. Over the year as a whole, there was an unrealised loss of £7.6 million as a result of marking to market seed positions. However, the successful realisations in the year crystallised a profit for shareholders of £4 million. And while this realised gain is a welcome outcome, it's worth remembering that the real strategic objective of the group's seed capital programme is in driving longer term growth in client AUM. And to illustrate this, the group's seeding activity to date has supported funds with more than $8.5 billion of client assets, representing about 10% of the group's total assets under management. In aggregate, therefore, profit before tax increased by 1% to £221.5 million. At £31.6 million, the tax charge was 4% lower year on year and implies an effective tax rate for the period of 16.6%, below the current UK corporation tax rate of 19% due to the geographic mix of profits, with some earnings being in lower tax jurisdictions and an increase in the value of the deferred tax asset relating to employee share awards. Based on the current geographic mix of the group's profits and recognising that other factors will continue to influence the achieved rate, the forecast underlying effective tax rate for the group is between 16 and 17%. On a statutory basis, therefore, diluted EPS increased by 3%. However, excluding foreign exchange translation effects and seed capital mark-to-market impact, the adjusted diluted EPS increased by 12% to 26.1 pence, reflecting the solid operational performance in the period. In line with the board's dividend policy and its target cover level of 1.5 times, the final dividend has been maintained at 12.1 pence per share to give a 2% increase in total dividends for the year of 16.9 pence. Consistent with the solid financial performance, the group generated £257.9 million of operating cash in the year. In addition to the payment of corporation tax and ordinary dividends, the EBT purchased shares worth £89.5 million to satisfy future equity awards to staff, and was able to buy opportunistically at lower market prices in the second half. The seed capital program realized cash in the period, and the other notable cash item was the proceeds of the IPO from Ashmore Indonesia in January, delivering £11.3 million. Therefore, the group ended the period with a £27 million increase in cash to £490.1 million. And finally, from me, a quick summary of the group's balance sheet and capital position. The structure of the balance sheet remains conservative and consistent, which, as we have seen before, delivers operational and strategic benefits through all stages of the market cycle. The Pillar 2 capital requirement increased by approximately £26 million this year to £147.3 million as a result of higher average seed capital and foreign exchange holdings and an increase in market volatility in the second half. Nonetheless, with total capital resources of over £700 million, the group continues to maintain a significant excess regulatory capital position, which is primarily held in liquid assets such as cash or readily accessible seed capital positions. The group's foreign exchange exposure continues to be weighted towards the US dollar, and the sensitivity to changes in the cable rate is largely unchanged from a year ago, at £5 million of profit before tax impact for each 5 cent move in the rate. I'll now pass you back to Mark to share his thoughts on the outlook for emerging markets before we take your questions.
Thanks, Tom. So outlook from here. Big challenges in the developed world. Emerging markets fundamentals, the demographics continue to be attractive, better GDP growth, lower debt, etc. I mean, these are all things we've been saying before, but if anything, it's the same but in spades now after enormous additions of debt to the developed world. We think we've got both superior equity growth prospects and attractive yields in dollars or other currencies to attract investors with high yield and investment grade markets. So a relatively strong place to be compared to DM has probably just got a little bit stronger. COVID-19 is going to be running around for a while. We hope we're getting a recovery in 2021. We would expect and plan for that. But the impact is going to vary in different places, depending upon different strategies for how to deal with it, both in the developed markets and in the emerging economies. And within the emerging economies, that gives us places to move around and be active. Next slide, please. So to summarize where we're at before we take some questions, solid financial performance, doing what it should do, given the way we've always been structured, operationally resilient, which is great. We put a global operating model in place for a reason. And the guys in that area have done a stellar job, but on a model that works. So the model has been very well and truly stress tested and has worked well. So touch wood of all forms, desk wise and mental. It's gone very well. And we expect it's in a position where it can continue to do so. Fixed income themes are generating strong alpha since April, as they should do, given that's the way things always work. Equity performance has again been strong, relative and absolute. COVID-19 impact medium term, we don't know, but it does give us opportunities. And so the trick here is to be nimble, keep your people safe, and to keep doing what you've always done. Don't mess with your process, talk to your clients, grind out the returns. Emerging markets are diverse, you know that. They offer attractive growth and yield, both for equity and fixed income. The market has recovered significantly. We are generating alpha and client flows. You always get the initial knee-jerk reaction. There's some of that. And over a period of time, that slows down, and that's all happening as we would expect it to be. So we're doing what we always do, and I'm looking forward to continue doing it. And thank you for your time and listening to us and your interest in us. And now we'll take Q&A.
Okay, we have four questions from Hayley Tam. And first, on costs. Can you quantify, please, how much of the 5% decline year on year was due to travel restrictions and remote working benefits in the second half, and whether you anticipate any of these benefits continuing into the longer term?
I think that's one for you, Tom. It's pretty scary, this voice from out of the ether. It's like God. Anyway, over to you. Can you respond to God?
Another padded cell, presumably. So the controllable cost element in the second half was approximately £1 million of reduction in other operating costs. The bulk of that, as you would anticipate, comes as a consequence of being more efficient in terms of running an office network that we're not inhabiting and restricting travel. But we've also been around all of our cost line items, as you would expect from us, to make sure that we're not buying data that we don't need, we haven't got Bloomberg licenses that we're not using, and just making sure that we've buttoned everything down as tightly as we can. Of that approximately million that we saved in the second half, about two-thirds of it, I would estimate, relates to sort of COVID efficiencies from not being in the offices or traveling. So there's a couple of hundred thousand of sort of ongoing benefit, and about £600,000-£700,000 worth of costs that I would expect to come back sort of online, if you like, once we get back into offices and start traveling again.
The second cost question is, the variable remuneration ratio of 19.5% was lower than we have seen for some time. Given the recent alpha generation for clients, would you encourage us to think about a return in the 2021 financial year to the 22-23% levels seen in recent years?
Should I take that one? If performance is good, then across the business, then we expect to pay people for it. If it isn't good, then we expect those of us who may not done that well will not get paid, and well, not get paid so well. So obviously it moves up and down depending on how we're doing. It will depend on a lot of factors. Investment performance, of course, is one. Client management is another. Continuing the excellent job in the operational side of things is another. You know, we'll look at it at the time, but as you will probably remember, I think we've been down as low as 11, 12, 13% before over the 25 years of the business. And we've been as high as 22.5. And I think we've told everyone we cap it at 25. So it will stay within that range. We thought it was appropriate this year because particularly from investment performance reasons that it should have been lower than last year.
Here's a question on client behavior. You highlight three key categories of client response to market dislocation. Some redeem capital quickly, others see an opportunity to increase allocations, and a third constituency take longer to decide what to do. Do you believe we have now already seen all the activity from the first two cohorts? So it is now a question of waiting for the third constituency to decide what to do. And what proportion of your clients fall into that third category that are waiting to see what to do?
I think certainly number one's happened. Number two, as I think I must have, for those of you who've been with us over the years, there's never enough of them, you know. Nobody ever buys when you tell them to. So what tends to happen is number two is a bit of a 2A and a 2B, but I guess it could creep into three as well. 2A sort of has happened, and 2B, where they might be thinking that now, given what they see the outlook for US interest rates and or EM growth v DM growth, and how expensive they see the tech market in the US, for example, we might get some people in 2B moving now. Number three, deciding what to do kind of starts, it's at different speeds, but I think this quarter, September through December and through to March, is kind of a typical time you would get for people to think about that, running across the Western world through to the Eastern world. So yes, I think we're in that place. And the answer to the follow-up question is I really don't have a very strong feel for that, because every time something like this happens, you're surprised one way or another. You're surprised by how rapidly people take decisions or don't, and then you're surprised by how slowly they do. So my view is that the retail product tends to see the most rapid reaction. So we're probably through a lot of that. And people now, the deciding what to do in retail will now be a second order set of decisions around, okay, so we had a terrible drawdown in life in some of the funds that did, not in equity, but in fixed income. How do we deal with that as we've seen a great recovery? Where do we go from here? So I think the last quarter is a key quarter for investor intentions. So we'll get a very strong flavor of investor intentions. When you have a nasty draw and a strong recovery, you then get I think we're hitting number three now in terms of what type of the client base, percentage of the client base. You could say I'm really making it up. I would say in the institutional space would be more likely than the retail space. And I think it's therefore 90% of the assets are institutional. And who knows? It could be half of them. It could be 10% of them. We just don't know until the conversations are had, and the conversations, they tend to start them and they tend to be ongoing. They're not like an immediate conversation.
I have a couple of questions on investment performance. Hayley's asking, with the assets under management that are quite close to benchmark but underperforming over 3 years, is there a particular bias by investment theme? And how long do you expect it to take for the three-year track records to return to above benchmarks?
In the three-year space, it's biased towards the higher yielder elements of external debt. So investment grade actually are all above, I think, with no exceptions. So investment grade in external and corporate, et cetera, are all fine. It's in the high yield space. So it would be more in the external space where there's high yield components, in the blended space with high yield components, and to a lesser extent in corporate. In equities, there's not really an issue. Is there another part to that question?
How long should we expect it to take for the three-year track record overall to move back above benchmark?
Well, if we keep going as we are, we would hope relatively rapidly. These things can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months. So we're 6 months in, and we would hope that progressively things will start crossing over the next 6 months or so. But we need to keep performing. Happily, again, touch wood, we've been performing pretty well in those themes since April. So let's keep it going.
There's a point of detail from David McCann at Numis. You highlight investment performance improving since March. This doesn't seem to be featuring in some of the public fund fact sheets on a 1, 3, and 5 year excess return basis. Is there a difference between the public fund fact sheets and the overall group picture?
No, we use composites, obviously, and this data comes from the data we're giving you is the overall group picture. So we should look into that and find out what that issue is. So if you want to run with that and give David some feedback directly, that'd be great.
Certainly. Next question is Paul McGuinness at Shore Capital. You say in the statement that Ashmore's investment process and team culture works better if office based. Has office attendance picked up from the low point?
Well, as you can see, still a low point for me. No, the answer is what we've done here is we're in 11 countries, I think, the last count. And what we do is we do everything in each country based on local government advice and on the management of the office. And so what we do is office by office, we create a return to work protocol, and that's cleared through London, through the head office. And then between the local office and the London office, they agree that it's a good time to go, and they go back to work on a variety of different bases. And we flex it. So in some places we've been back and we've had to go back out again. So for example, in Jakarta, we were back in the office for a period, and then there's been a flare up in Jakarta. We're back working from home again. And it's very much driven by what's happening on the ground. So it's country by country. So there's not like a group global solution. In terms of UK, for example, we're not back in the office. We're still working from home fully. We're looking at what happens to infection rates, to government advice, to people using public transport again over the next month or so. And obviously we would like to get back in the office when we can, but we're not going to do anything that we think overly jeopardizes the health of our colleagues and friends. So we'll take it case by case.
Tom Mills at Jefferies asked, do you think the Fed can stimulate inflation, and will you need to rebalance in response?
The answer is it believes it. It's kind of hoping. They're kind of hoping they can. I think the real way to stimulate inflation is a big jump in economic activity, and that tends to be preceded by a boost in confidence. They're in a situation now where confidence is pretty low in the US, not simply because of economic activity and because of what's going on in various companies, but because of what's happening politically. So I think they need to get through the election, and they need to do a bit of healing in terms of politics, because this is always a very divisive period coming up to presidential elections. They need to get through that. They need to get a bit of healing. They need to get a bit of confidence back. They need to have a strategy. And once confidence starts, economic activity will increase, and then you can stimulate more inflation. We will, of course, need to adjust to that. Our view at the minute is it's unlikely they can stimulate much inflation in the next 6 months or so, maybe longer. So we're not frightened today of US inflation. Having said that, what you do get, and this is the inflation point is a bit too general a statement. You are getting within different industries, and we're seeing this in the UK as well, you're getting bottlenecks in the supply chain for certain kinds of parts of product. So things that are beginning to pick up in terms of growth activity, all the businesses that are benefiting from people stopping traveling and having more money, and people sitting at home looking at their padded cell going, Jesus, I want a different color curtain. Those kind of people are stimulating domestic economic activity. But that can only be produced if there's enough people to manufacture it and there's enough product for it. So some of that home supply stuff, you know, there can be shortages of different kinds of things, and that can create inflation within certain sectors for certain goods. But anyway, on a broad basis, I think they can eventually, but I don't think they can in the short run.
Two questions from Arno at Exan, one on the dividend and one on the local businesses. How should we read the flat dividend in the second half after growing 5% in the first half? And how much headroom would you like above your 1.5 times target?
I'm going to let you take that one, Tom, because I've talked too much.
No problem. So look, clearly, as I mentioned in my script, that the year was quite different in terms of half one and half two. Half one was very positive in terms of performance, client flows, financial delivery. Therefore, it felt appropriate to nudge the dividend up after a period of having held it flat. So the interim dividend went up by 5%. Clearly, after the more challenging environment of the second half and the more uncertain outlook from here in terms of the medium-term impact of COVID, notwithstanding the progress that's been made since March in terms of the recovery and the consistent delivery of Alpha, the board felt it was appropriate to maintain the final dividend flat. That means the cover level comes in at just over 1.5 times. I think on a statutory basis, it's 1.52. And as we've said before in these meetings, the 1.5 is a floor. We would like to have a bit of a cushion above the 1.5 times over time. So, you know, we would like to think that we can grow EPS ahead of DPS growth going forward. Clearly, the strength of the balance sheet, the capital position and the liquidity on the balance sheet underpins the consistent, conservative and over time progressive dividend policy that we've implemented for many years.
And on the local platforms, are there more listings of local businesses to come? And specifically, how do you think about China? Is it a priority in the context of other asset managers setting up joint ventures in the country?
You want me to take that one as well? Okay. The float in Indonesia, I think, has been a good thing internally and externally. The management teams, as we've talked about, with this group before, own equity in their local management companies, and so the progress, the success and the scale, profitability, etc., that's been achieved in Indonesia facilitated the IPO. It's only a small amount of new capital that was raised. About 10% of the company's shares were sold in that listing, but it acted as a flag internally to all of the other local management teams in Riyadh, in Bogota, in Mumbai, etc., that this is one of the options for us as we can grow their franchises as well. So a number of the conversations that Mark and I had with the CEOs around the group in January, February time were acknowledging the IPO in Indonesia and what that could mean for them over the medium term as their own local franchises grow and develop. I think it's worth noting that Indonesia has been sort of the best performer of the group of local market businesses over the recent few years. It was probably therefore logical that it was the first one to come to market. It'll be a couple of years, I think, before the others produce another candidate for listing, but absolutely it is one of the options for us as we grow the franchises locally and try and broaden their appeal to clients in country as well as international institutional clients. Sorry, there was a second part of the question, I think.
Is China a priority in the context of other asset managers setting up joint ventures in the country?
I think so. You may remember we have a small financial stake in a mutual fund company based in Shanghai. We're happy maintaining that stake for now. But I think it's fair to say that some of the other local market businesses in Colombia, in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, in India at the moment offer, we believe, better profitable growth prospects.
There's three more questions. First is on equities from Mike Werner at UBS. After the strong inflows in the 2020 year, how were they weighted between retail and institutional clients? And how are the new mandates being priced relative to the 66 basis points overall for the equities business?
Do you have the exact percentages on the weighting, Tom, on retail v institutional for 20?
I don't to hand, but I can get it and get it back to
you. Yeah, let's get it back to the question. I mean, but just at the highest level, we had a very strong growth in retail through the beginning of 20. And retail went up to about 15-16% of our assets. And it then dropped off again because strong redemptions after that. So it's down about 11-12 now. So there was more in retail than institution as a percentage of AUM. What was the second part of the question, please, Paul?
How is the pricing of the new business being won in equities? How does it compare to the 66 basis points overall for equities as a theme?
We think we price fairly. We're not having to do anything in terms of, we're not over aggressive in terms of trying to be the most expensive person in the world, but we're also not trying to be the cheapest. So we're winning equity mandates, and market pricing will be driven very much by the market. We think our numbers, we're where we should be, which is what we've got strong performance over 3 and 5 years in all the themes. And that will raise capital at the market price. There's no reason for us to try and be aggressive on pricing to raise more assets. The money will come if we keep performing. And the minute the guys are doing a great job, it'll come.
A question from Gurjit. In a risk-averse environment, do you typically see greater flows from existing clients and maybe smaller mandate sizes? I'm just trying to gauge the potential impact on revenue margins from these dynamics.
I'm happy to take that. In a risk-averse environment, you just tend to see less flow That whole 2B where people get around to add, well, so number one, in the first question ages ago, where people are supposed to add when it's cheap, doesn't really happen. It does happen with some people, but not with many. If it's existing clients, it can be quite large top-ups as a percentage of their mandates. I think we've seen that from the people we're going to see that. As I say, we're now into stage 2/3. Existing client flow will be lower as a proportion of their existing mandate. They're not always doubling the mandate. So you're right in that. They tend to be adding 10, 20, 30%, maybe 50%. However, what tends to happen in a difficult market is when people are giving you money, they tend to say, oh, by the way, have we just, you know, should we get a better price because we now give you, you know, have a billion with you as opposed to 600 million, or you have 300 million with you rather than 150 or 180 or something. So there's a trade-off in that. So I think it's very hard to sort of extrapolate a robust sort of set of, you know, forecasts around that. The general rule of thumb for me, and I'm sure for all of you, is that whenever markets are difficult, people try and screw you on price. I mean, what are we doing to our suppliers but trying to drive down price? We're a supplier to our clients. They're going to try and drive down price. So if markets are difficult and you are going to have people attacking you on price. And also, generally in life, people are always trying to drop your margins down. So if you're a product supplier, you're always fighting to defend your margin. So, and this is, you've seen this over many, many years with us. Our job is to try and defend our revenue margin whilst managing our costs to give ourselves a very strong net margin. And we happily, touch wood, have been able to do that. And we're going to keep trying to do that. So can't give you a rule to follow, unfortunately.
Okay, last two questions from Haley again. You're clearly very excited about the prospects for fundraising in the all cap equity funds as they approach their 3-year milestone. How much of the current $4.6 billion of equities AUM is in the all cap equity strategy? And how would you encourage us to think about the potential scale of fund flow potential here?
Well, I mean, we gave you a number for the period just passed of $1.2 billion across the piece. And that was, for us, given where we came from, a pretty good number. So if we're raising that sort of money, that's not bad at all. But we'd obviously like to grow that to higher numbers. It takes many, many years to get to the point where you're looking to raise 10 billion a year in fixed income. We're not going to raise 10 billion a year in equities, but well, not yet. I have to say it to fill my distribution colleagues who are listening, maybe next year, not this. But the bottom line is at $1 billion, that's made a significant difference to us. And we'd be looking for more than that every year going forward from here. And let's hope they can achieve that.
And the last question from Hubert Lam, what has been the response by your existing institutional clients to your recent weak performance? Has the negative reaction mainly been from retail clients?
I think they've all been delighted. I think every client gets a bit depressed / fed up, as do we, if we have negative performance. We get hopefully less fed up because we stick to our knitting and we know that's what happens if we keep following our process. You are going to get a period of underperformance. It has been sharp this time, but it was sharp before in global financial crisis and other situations. You know, back in even 94, I remember, you know, it can be really sharp. So nobody likes it. Certainly retail can vote with their feet quickly. At the margin, they can be quick. Institutional tends to vote with their feet longer. They fall into that category three more, you know, where they think about what they're going to do. Different conversations with different people. Obviously, we talk to them a lot, and the conversations now are considerably perkier than they were in April, May. So, yeah, nobody likes it, and we don't like it. And we say to them, look, we're sorry, it is our process, but we don't like it either, and we want to outperform for you. So it's our fault. We're going to do it. Let us get on with it, and we'll talk to you as often as you want. So, yeah, nobody likes it.
Okay, there are no more questions.
Great, thank you. Well, if there are no more questions, and I gather from Paul or Godot that there are not, thank you very much indeed for coming and for being here and sharing our padded cells with us. We appreciate the fact that you follow us, you know, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to follow us over a screen like this. And look, we're continuing to do what we do. We like our business. We've always liked it. We love it when things are a bit more difficult, and they've been a bit more difficult. So it's a really good time for us looking forward from here. And we're hoping we're going to give you and your customers a good ride from here. So thank you very much. And I hope we'll see you in person next time around. Thanks very much, everybody. Thanks for your time and for coming. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Tom.